So what we said in the last session was that things appear to us to exist independent of us, and things have always appeared to exist independent of us, and so we never question these appearances. We just grasp onto things. There's an independent me here, an independent objective world there. And as we saw in this suffering and its causes chart the other day, that fundamental ignorance leads to mental afflictions, suffering, and that's why we're stuck in this state of dukkha. So what this view of emptiness is saying, that the Buddha taught in these Perfection of Wisdom Sutra teachings, is that things are not independently existent. And so often you'll hear that described as things are empty of inherent existence. So remember, inherent existence is another word for independent existence. So things are empty of inherent existence is the same as saying things are not independently existent. Why? Because they are dependently existent. And the word used there is dependent arising. The word arising means coming into existence. So things coming into existence dependently. So again, this frames that things are empty of inherent existence. This empty of inherent existence, this is emptiness. Or in Sanskrit, shunyata. So emptiness is not saying nothing really exists. Emptiness is saying everything is empty of independent existence. Everything lacks independent existence. Why? Because they are dependently existent. So if we can understand how things are dependently existent, that's going to help us to understand emptiness, to understand why they're not independently existent. So what I'd like to do now is look at what do we mean by the fact that things are dependently existent, and if we can start to appreciate that, we can start to get a better idea of emptiness. Now, there are at least three ways in which things exist dependently, or come into existence dependently. The first is causes and conditions. Everything arises through causes and conditions. The example we looked at, I think, already the other day, when we talked about substantial cause and cooperative condition, is the seed and the plant. The plant exists depending on causes and conditions. The underlying substantial cause is the seed. That's what transforms into the result. But of course, we need all the conditions of soil, sunlight, water, and so forth for the seed to become the plant. So everything that exists is created through causes and conditions. Generally, that's something we sort of more or less appreciate already.
But the seed itself needs a cause.
The what?
Condition. The seed itself makes the plant.
Of course it does. The seed needs all the material that the plant used to produce the seed.
And so I can ask you about the materials and so on.
Yeah, so as we saw in the material world, then if we keep going back, we'll say, well, where did the first matter start? When did it begin? And the answer, according to classical physics, is there's no beginning. That you can't create matter and energy. You can only transform it. So even at the physical world level, according to classical physics, there is no beginning. Because then we have to say something comes into existence without causes and conditions, which from a classical physics perspective is illogical, it's not possible. Conservation of mass energy. Similarly, consciousness, the Buddhist theory of conservation of consciousness. You can't have a first moment of mind because then that would be created not through causes and conditions, it would just come into existence. So whether it's in Buddhism or classical physics, whether it's physical or mental phenomena, everything that exists comes into existence through causes and conditions.
From a quantum physics perspective,
there are a lot of different interpretations.
Yes, one of the interpretations, there is this, you know, minimum level of existence.
Minimum level.
Kind of field of
superimposition study.
Yeah. The quantum field.
Quantum field.
This plants level, you know? Plants.
Sure.
Okay. So then that is the, we can see the beginning, so there is no this infinite.
But that's maybe that's the beginning of manifest phenomena.
Yeah.
It's okay. In the same way, atomic particles is the beginning of all material phenomena. We can say the same. Does that mean atoms, that things are produced without causes and conditions? No. We have to then look at this quantum field. I mean, that's something, isn't it? It exists. It exists through causes and conditions, doesn't it? Probably. I don't know. Yeah. Okay, second point. That also, of course, things exist depending on their parts. This laptop, for example, here, exists, of course, through causes and conditions, but also parts. Without the frame, without the keyboard, without the screen, the battery, electronic components, there would be no laptop. So everything exists depending on their parts. Again, fairly straightforward. I think we can appreciate that. But remember, what we're saying here is that the fact that things exist dependently should be overturning our idea that they exist independently. And I think most of us are happy to accept that this laptop exists depending on causes and conditions, and it exists depending on its parts, yet at the same time, we're probably happy to accept the fact that there's already a laptop existing here on the table when we walk in the door. True? According to this logic, that should be impossible. Either the laptop is independent or it's dependent. Can't be both. So why can we happily accept those two appearingly contradictory things? The reason is, we only understand these things at a very superficial level. To appreciate these at a deeper level, we have to look at the third way in which things are dependent. And here you'll see a lot of different terms, and they all mean the same thing. That things exist through imputation, through labelling, through conception, through designation. So if you understand the meaning of one of those words, you understand all of them, because they're saying the same thing. So again, when we look at this, and we think, I think I know what that means. There's a thing on the table here. We're calling it a laptop. Again, this is a fairly superficial understanding of this concept, this idea. To understand this at a deeper level, we can understand that when we look out on the world, what we receive is a mass of sense data, particularly visual data. And then we have to make some sense or meaning out of all of this stuff. Otherwise, we couldn't function. We couldn't survive. So what we do is we create meaningful things. We draw lines around various collections of data and create objects to make meaning out of this world. But not only do we draw lines around various collections of data to create a meaningful object for us, we need to do more than that, because we're not living in a world of isolation, we're living with others. So to be able to communicate with others, we have to give names to the things that we've created so we can communicate. So this process here, this idea of labelling, conception and designation, is this process of drawing a line, creating the object, and then giving a name. That whole process is this. Now, how we do this line drawing is not fixed. It's completely arbitrary, depending on the meaning we want to get out of what we experience. For example, how many things are there? How many objects are here? Is there one star? Is there two triangles? Is there six triangles? Is there six triangles and a hexagon? Is there a collection of 18 lines? So, from its own side, independent of our conception, how many objects are there? Independent of our conception, how many objects are there? We can't even give an answer, because they exist within our conceptual framework. We draw a line and create one object, the star. We draw two lines and create two triangles. Six lines and six triangles. We determine how many objects are there. They do not exist from their own side, independent of our conceptual framework. So therefore, you find the terminology used here is that things are merely labelled. And the word merely means only, just, nothing more than that. That star only exists within our conceptual framework, our labelling. And another term you will find here is that things are not findable. Meaning, you will not find a star in the basis from its own size. You cannot find a star there, because the star comes only into existence in our conceptual framework. There is no star to be found here from its own side, independent of our conceptual framework. This is what this means. Now, we need to draw lines and create objects. If we don't, we can't function, we wouldn't survive. There is no problem there at all. The problem is, we don't realise that's what we're doing. Instinctively, when we look here, we say, that's a star. There's a star there. That was on the board before we walked in the door. There was a star existing from its own side there, independent of our conceptual framework. That's how we relate to things. But what we can see is that that's false, that the star only exists within our conceptual framework. And so again, what we do is through these stains in our mind, things appear to exist independent of us, so we grasp onto them in that way. So what we are doing is we are turning our line that we draw, we're turning that into a boundary, a hard boundary. We are believing that the world is already divided up into many separate, discrete things. That's the problem. The boundaries. Believing the world is divided up already. Why is that a problem? Why is the problem to see the world divided up already? We already went through that. Suffering and its causes chart. Grasping onto independent me, independent world leads to mental afflictions, actions, and dukkha. Now, a couple more things, and then I'm sure there's lots of questions. Let's now go back and look at these two ideas again, causes and conditions and paths, based on this idea, and see if we can understand these a little bit deeper. So this is a timeline, this is the seed, and this is the plant that it produces. So we said the plant exists depending on causes and conditions. The underlying cause is the seed, conditions are soil, sunlight, water, and so on. The question is, at what point does the seed become the plant? Now we believe things exist independently. Independent of our conceptual framework, which means, if that's the case, it should be a fixed, obvious point where the seed becomes the plant. Where is that point? When does the seed become the plant?
What's the definition of the plant?
This is the answer.
Not because I cannot see the point, that there is no point.
There is a point.
We don't know. I cannot see the exact moment where the seed becomes the plant, but it's not because I cannot see that, because maybe my tools or my senses are limited, that there is no point.
We're speaking very simply here. We're not talking at an atomic level. Very simply, in a worldly way.
Depends on the label.
Exactly. Exactly. So the answer is that we determine when the seed becomes the plant. We bring the plant into existence when this configuration of data stops looking like our concept of seed and starts looking like our concept of plant. And of course, each one of us have a slightly different concept of what a seed and a plant is. So for some of us, this is already the plant. For some of us, it's here, some of us here. We determine when the plant comes into existence. Related to that, here's another question. The seed and the plant are in a cause and effect relationship. And by definition, if two things are in a cause and effect relationship, they cannot exist simultaneously, by definition. So the question is, and we think about this, does the seed stop existing before the plant comes into existence? So don't blurt it out, just think about it for a moment. Does the seed stop existing before the plant comes into existence? There can only be two answers, yes or no. Which is it?
No,
it means then the seed and plant are existing at the same time. By definition, illogical. So no is illogical. Yes, seed has ceased to exist. Where is the plant coming from? It ceased to exist. Where is the plant coming from now? Yes is illogical. Both no and yes are illogical. Why? Because believing in independent existence makes common sense ideas like cause and effect illogical. Illogical. And Nagarjuna, who's actually the founder of, from the second century, the founder of what's called the Majjhimika philosophical system, which is the one we're talking about here, he has a classic text in Sanskrit called Mula Majjhimika Karika, or in English, Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way. And he has 27 chapters of these arguments. He says, you believe in independent existence? What about cause and result? How does that work? You believe in independent existence? How does agent and action work? Fire and fuel? How do these things work? And then when we look at it, we go, oh, actually it doesn't work anymore. It's illogical. So these are very powerful arguments to help us to overcome the grasping onto independent existence. So, of course, seed and plant are in a cause and effect relationship. But if we believe they exist independently, we have this logical absurdity. But if we don't believe in that, then we can hold on to cause and effect because we're just simply changing the label. Then it works. Similarly, and on that point, is the idea of impermanence. Superficially, when we think about impermanence, and often it's explained that things are changing moment by moment, then we think, okay, that means in this moment there's a thing, and it turns into something else in the next moment, and that turns into something else in the next moment. Is this impermanence? Can this work? Impossible, for the same reasons. Illogical. So impermanence is not this, it's this. So if we, and what this is it's making a boundary. It's making a boundary. There's a thing there that becomes another thing. Doesn't work. It's illogical. Whereas impermanence is this. And in that flow, in this flow, we create lines to create seeds and plants to make sense of this flow. But if we break up that and make the line into a boundary and turn these created objects into things that exist from their own side, everything becomes illogical. It's impossible. It doesn't work. One other point. We say the plant exists depending on causes and conditions. Or in other words, the result depends on the cause. But this view is also saying the cause depends on the result. How does the cause depend on the result? How does the seed depend on the plant?
Otherwise it wasn't the cause.
Exactly. You can't call something a cause unless you have the idea result. You can't call something a seed unless you have the idea plant. Whether or not it produces it is irrelevant. So also, cause depends on result. One more point on the parts. Pen, like everything, exists depending on its parts. But is there a pen to be found here? Can you find a pen here amongst the parts? Is this a pen? Nope. Is this a pen? Nope. Is this tube a pen? No. Is this plastic tube a pen? No. Is the ink a pen? No. Is the round ball a pen? Is the other bit of metal a pen? No. Where's the pen? And people go, oh, that's easy. It's the collection of that stuff. The pen is the collection of the parts. Okay, here's the collection. Oh, no. It has to be in a certain shape. Okay. You have to tell me when the pen comes into existence.
Oh, yeah.
Can we?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yes?
Depends on...
What about that? Oh, I don't need that. So what we can understand here is we determine when the pen comes into existence. There's no pen existing from its own side. The pen is not the collection of the parts. The pen is merely labelled depending on the collection of the parts. If we can appreciate those two statements are not saying the same thing, we're beginning to understand something about emptiness. So again, the two statements are the pen is the collection of the parts versus the pen is merely labelled depending on the collection of the parts. And again, one more point. The pen, the whole, depends on its parts. But also this view is saying the part depends on the whole. Again, for the same reason. You can only call this a part of a pen if you have the idea pen. Whether or not the pen exists is irrelevant. It's only a part if we have the idea whole. So parts depend on whole as well. So again, the pen, like everything that exists, every object is merely labelled depending on its parts. The object is not the collection of the parts. Because if the object was the collection of the parts, if there was a pen there from its own side, independent of our conceptual framework, it would mean that everyone who walked in the door would see pen. So then a caveman would walk in, they'd see pen, they'd start writing with it. I think a caveman may see some sort of weapon to stab with. And then, of course, if a dog came in here, maybe see a chewing stick. And then if a tiny ant came here, they may see a home to live in. So is this a pen, a weapon, a chewing stick, or a home? From its own side, none of those things. From the side of the observer, all of those things. I think there was one more point I wanted to mention. Yes. So here, again, comes our old friend cognitive fusion creating problems for us. Cognitive fusion here is pen versus basis or parts. So the pen is labelled, the label is applied to the basis. The label is not the basis. But we do cognitive fusion. We say, this is a pen. So we are fusing the label to the basis. And that's a problem because for this reason we saw. So rather, correctly, pen is something we are labelling to the basis. So there's a pen, there's what's called, the technical word is designated phenomena, and the basis of designation. The basis of labelling and the labelled object are two distinct things. And the label is applied to the basis. It's not the basis. But of course, they're not two independent things either. They are dependent, but they're not the same thing. And one thing that does, one, in a practical level, one difficulty that brings us when we fuse the label to the basis in anything is the basis of anything is always changing. The label is static, not changing. So when we fuse them together, it's much more easy to see the basis as static, unchanging. So that also creates problems. Okay, questions?
Cannot you say that you don't need the word part and you can only satisfy with bottom and labeling because when you say that something is from its part, it's like from its positive condition, only if the parts will be together, so they will create the
mean, these two things are not very different. This one is temporal. Is a temporal, and parts is present moment.
Okay, so
what I mean, the same thing, really.
For time and fluid for, I don't know, space.
Is in present moment.
Yeah, okay.
Now, this is more a temporal description.
Is there a danger, or does a danger arise in this for, like, the nihilism type of...
Exactly. That was the next topic. I'll bring it in right now. In this way of thinking, is there a danger of nihilism, thinking nothing exists? Yes, absolutely. As we've already seen in other areas, where we often get caught in two extremes. You know, like in the shamatha practice, we're caught in the extreme of distraction or dullness. And in other areas, in different sorts of two extremes. Similarly here, we have what's called the two extremes. And the two extremes are existence and non-existence. The extreme of existence, of course, is believing in or grasping to independent existence. Now, everything that has ever appeared to us in our life has always appeared to exist independently. So there's no reason for us to question these appearances. And for us now, there are just two possibilities. Either there is this independent me and independent world, or there's no me and no world. Because we don't see any other possibility. So what often happens, of course, is when we investigate the supposed independent world, when we come to realize it's not independent, in other words, when we come to realize emptiness, that there is no independent me, no independent world, when we start to come to understand and realize that, the most common consequence of that is we simply flip to the other extreme of non-existence or nihilism, because we do not see any other possibility. Either there is an independent me, independent world, or there's no me and no world. So, to help us avoid flipping to this extreme, and this often happens particularly in meditation, when we're, maybe happened to some of you in the meditation this morning, looking for this me, couldn't find, and we go, oh, I'm not here, I'm not here, I'm not here. And that's the most common way of understanding emptiness, is that, okay, I can't find me, so I don't exist. So we flip to this extreme of nihilism. But to help us to overcome nihilism, we reflect on the flip side of emptiness. Dependent arising. To reflect on the fact that things do exist, and that things exist depending on cause and conditions, parts, and labelling. And of course, included there is me. I exist depending on cause and conditions, parts, and labelling. And another practical advice, because actually this afternoon we're going to be doing a little emptiness meditation with Renato. Another little practical advice, if you're doing this sort of emptiness meditation looking for the person and you're not finding, one of the most common experiences, of course, is fear coming up. And if you have fear coming up in this meditation, it's usually a very good sign. It means you're doing your investigation in a correct way and you're coming to realize there's no independent me. But you are misinterpreting that experience to mean there's no me at all. So If you're having fear coming up, thinking there's no me or I'm going out of existence, one thing, of course, to help avoid that in future is to really understand this better, that there is a dependent me. But in the moment, in the meditation, if you have fear coming up, thinking I don't exist or I'm going out of existence, what we can do is ask, who's having the fear? Because if there's no me, there can be no fear. So you're not going out of existence. There, and that's what I did a little bit this morning. I said, you know, even if you didn't find this me, isn't there someone who's experiencing all of this? So there is a me. So rather than developing fear, if we reflect on emptiness and dependent arising more, we can understand this not finding doesn't mean there's no me. It means there's no independent me. And actually that not finding experience is an experience of emptiness. So if you get to the point of investigating in this meditation and you don't find the me, then stop investigating and just hold that experience of not finding as long as you can. Just sit there and hold that. Because that's an experience of emptiness, and allow that to penetrate more into your mind. The more that you can hold it in meditation, the more that will then affect your mind even after the meditation. And what you will find is that if that experience still is affecting the mind a little bit after the meditation, what you will find is that generally you'll be much more peaceful, quiet, much less mental afflictions, much more level of kindness and compassion spontaneously, and this feeling of connection with the universe. And of course, that'll wear off. And then you go, oh, that was so nice. And then, of course, often what people do go, oh, I really like that experience. I want that. I need that. And so they go into their next meditation craving that experience. And then, of course, that craving blocks having that experience. And then they just get frustrated. So we don't want to do that. If we have this experience, then rather than craving it, understand it's a valid experience and we're heading in the right direction, and then go into meditation again without expectation, without craving, and just do the practice again. Because craving this experience is going to block our progress. So, again, therefore, this fear or falling to nihilism, very common, but again, how to overcome it is understanding that that fear is completely irrational, and that there is a middle way here, that there is emptiness and dependent arising is the middle way between existence and non-existence. Any other questions?
So to highlight that middle way, would it not be, like, I feel like it would be, because this makes sense, it just makes more sense to me to be more dualistic about things and say that things do and do not have inherent existence. Because that's what I got from the Alan Wallace reading, was that it makes sense to say things exist inherently or objectively in the sense that there is an objective world out there. But it does not make sense in the sense that that is not something that we can have experience, because we, by default, have to experience things.
Sure.
So why say that there's no independent existence? There is an independent existence, it's just that we can't have effectively there isn't, because we can't ever experience it ourselves.
Again, what we can understand, begin to understand here is, and from a Buddhist perspective, scientific materialism have got it completely backwards, is scientific materialism asserts that matter and energy is primary, and that any talk about mind or consciousness is just a property, emerging property out of that. Buddhism would say it's completely opposite. Consciousness is primary. And as long as we're holding on to matter and energy's primary, we're always going to be grasping onto there. Well, there is an independent reality. I just can't experience it.
Well, that's technically accurate.
What's that?
The matter which is primary.
But there is
a collection of matter that makes up the laptop.
But we're not talking about whether a matter or energy exists. We're talking about what's primary in the universe. We're not saying Buddhism. Not saying there's no matter and energy.
Right.
We're not saying that.
So, but there is no primary and secondary. There is
is just that there is a collection of matter and energy, and we happen to perceive it as left.
But again, that's inbuilt, is the assumption there must that must exist there independent of our mind.
No.
Well, that's what you're saying.
Why?
Isn't it?
No, why?
Oh, okay. So there's matter and energy,
yeah.
And whether or not it's independent of our mind, we need to determine.
No,
correct?
It is dependent on us. It is,
well, is it dependent or independent? It can't be both.
Well, it can be both. That's what I'm saying.
How can something exist dependently and independently?
Well, what happened to your dualism?
Sorry?
Things can exist. If you take us out of the equation, things exist independently. But we can't experience them as independent. Because
so then, your position is that basically things exist independently. That's what you're saying?
No,
isn't it?
Why not?
That's what you just said.
Things exist independently and dependently at the same time.
Yeah, but so the first part is they exist independently. Yeah, okay. So you accept that.
Yeah.
Buddhism would reject that idea. So anyway, but what Buddhism would say is that this is the Buddhist theory. It's just a theory. We need to test it. You know, how do things exist? We will never have 100% answer intellectually. We need to directly experience how things exist. Until then, it's just another theory. May or may not be accurate, may or not be correct, may or may not be helpful to us.
If you're not a nihilist, you're saying that things exist, have an independent existence.
Hmm?
If you're not a nihilist, things have an independent existence.
That's what we think. Buddhism says these are the two extremes, and for us, these are the only two possibilities.
I'm not talking about things in the sense of concept, I'm talking about things in the sense of pure matter.
Sure. So, exactly your point is these are the only two possibilities.
No, that's definitely not it.
It's not?
I'm saying there's a... Well, I don't really believe it, but things exist dependently and there's a middle ground, and that's what I'm saying. It would be
yeah.
accurate to say that they exist.
Yeah, but what I'm suggesting is that your interpretation of that is maybe not the same idea as this.
Okay.
That's what I'm suggesting.
Okay.
Yeah. And then you can report back to me. Very good.
Buddhism doesn't really like the idea of determination because
I didn't hear what you said. Buddhism doesn't like
the idea of determination because
I didn't catch it again. So it doesn't like what?
The idea of
determination.
Determination of I didn't understand what you said. Buddhism doesn't like what? Determination. What do you mean by determination?
If you say like this is a pen because it causes the danger of cognitive fusion because we make something.
Yeah. So, I mean, of course we can say this is a pen as long as our understanding is pen is something I'm labeling to this, then it's fine. Buddhism, what, sorry? Something about beginning of life?
Determine, like, the life begins at this point. It's a labeling, isn't it?
Right.
Like, we label life begins at conception.
Because it's a useful concept. It's meaningful and helpful. And?
Like, is that why, because you told us, like, Buddhism defines life at the beginning, like, with the conception.
Because life... Correct.
Okay, but it's a labeling which is done on...
Everything's merely labeled, yes, and then?
Okay. So, like, it doesn't mean we should, like, get distance from the labeling, but we still label things.
We need to understand that we're labeling. That's the point. We need to understand that things are existing in our conceptual framework and not independent of that. That's the whole point here. If we stop labeling, we couldn't function. We couldn't survive in the world. Nothing would have meaning.
Yeah, but if it's a label, like life begins at this point, we could also put a label into another.
Sure, if it's more meaningful and useful, we can do that, of course.
Okay, but Buddhism says life begins at the conception.
Because the consciousness and the fertilized the body come together at that point.
Okay, so Buddhism labels at this point.
Sure.
My
Sure.
But like, it could also, Buddhism would also change this labeling to another point if it would make more sense.
Sure, why not? I mean, if it's meaningful and helpful and beneficial, we can do all sorts of labeling. And that's what we do in our life, is we are continually improving our line drawing and labeling to make better and better meaning out of our world. When we were very young, our ability to draw lines and give concepts was very basic. And as we grew up, that continually improves. And even now, we're improving it. You know, often if we go into some new situation we've never been into before, we look at what's in front of us and we scratch our head and go, what's that? No idea. We don't know how to draw the line. So it forces us to try and draw lines and create things to make some sense to us. So we're continually improving that process. But the key is knowing that's what we're doing. That's the point.
So I'm still a bit stuck with this example of the tree.
The tree, yes.
And I'm not sure if I understood correctly that the main problem is the labeling. For example, when we did the meditation at 9 and I got a gaze on Emily's table, I saw a thing and my first thought was, oh, she has a laptop. Where's the laptop coming from? And then when I took a briefer look, I saw, oh, it's just her notebook. And this was my labeling. So still I think I understand that this thing is existing dependently. So there are causes and conditions to it. There are different parts. And then I'm labeling.
Right.
But only because I have another label than
right.
perhaps.
But
because he is closer, or he
but,
is
but
in
this,
you,
yeah.
it's still there.
Exactly.
The thing.
What thing?
Whatever thing. I saw...
Didn't you create a thing? Didn't you create a thing? Didn't you draw a line around certain collection of colours and shape?
I'm creating a line around the
it's colours and shape.
The
data.
Yes.
So there's just data, and
yeah.
in your visual field there's a whole mass of data, and in the middle of that visual field, within a particular sub-collection of data, you drew a line and created laptop. Correct?
And what thing is then there?
Hmm?
But what is the thing which is there? It's just data.
From its own side. No, there's no laptop from its own side. You created the laptop, or mistakenly created the laptop in this case. And so in this case, your labeling was not so meaningful and effective. It was not going to be very helpful for you to think of that as a laptop. So, of course, we need to create meaningful objects that are meaningful for us in our world. If we can create all sorts of stuff, but, of course, it's not meaningful and it can create even problems if we create things that are not meaningful.
Yeah, well, and then I got it, okay, it's another thing, so I found another label.
Sure.
But what's
sure.
then actually there?
Nothing. Independent of your conceptual framework. As Alan Wallace said in his initial thing, even if we take it down to electrons, atoms, quarks, Higgs boson, isn't that a concept? Isn't Higgs boson a concept that was developed to try to explain why material has weight? Isn't it? Has anyone ever seen a Higgs boson? No. They've seen data, and from that they can infer the idea that of Higgs boson, which is a useful concept to help us to explain why things have weight. Isn't it? Anyway, I think I need to move on a little bit, do a few more things, and then maybe some more questions. As I mentioned here, we tend to be stuck in these two extremes. And that when we first come into this Vipassana practice and we come to understand and have a little taste of emptiness, then often we do flip to the other extreme. And we sort of then have this idea that emptiness means nothing really exists. And I hear this a lot. Even people who've studied and maybe probably not meditated, but studied and thought about emptiness quite a lot. I even hear people say, even after thinking and reflecting on emptiness for some time, I hear people saying, it doesn't matter because everything's empty. That is the complete wrong understanding of emptiness. The correct understanding of emptiness is because things are empty, everything matters. So if we have the idea, oh, nothing really matters because everything's empty, this is nihilism, or heading in that direction. Because remember, emptiness and dependent arising are like two sides of a coin. So the measure, one measure, and so here as a beginner, for us there are two possibilities. Either there is this real functioning world, or everything's empty and nothing really exists. That's where we tend to be stuck now. And so we often say, if things are empty, they can't function. That's often what we feel. The measure of a correct understanding of emptiness is, because things are empty, they can function. That's the correct understanding of emptiness. That emptiness and dependent arising are two sides of a coin. Because if this laptop was inherently a laptop from its own side, it couldn't change. It couldn't become anything else. It couldn't function. You couldn't create it. You couldn't destroy it. But because it's not a laptop from its own side, therefore it does function. You can create it. You can destroy it. So this is a measure of our understanding of emptiness. If our understanding of emptiness is reinforcing our idea of a dependent functioning world, and if our view of the world is reinforcing the idea that there's nothing existing from its own side, then we have a good understanding of emptiness. That is the measure, that emptiness and dependent arising functioning world are two sides of one coin. A poetic way of saying this is, emptiness is fullness, fullness is emptiness. One analogy, I've got a little quote here from Nagarjuna, who, of course, talks about emptiness a lot. He says, that which arises dependently and relatedly is explained as being empty, and that which is empty is dependently designated. This is the middle way path. Now, to also help us better understand emptiness, there are a number of analogies used in the text. Like with the Four Noble Truths, to understand Four Noble Truths, one useful analogy was the physical illness, the diagnosis, prognosis, cure. With emptiness, there are many analogies used to help us better understand what we mean by emptiness. One analogy that I found very useful, is the analogy of a dream. When we're dreaming now, in the dream, there appears to be an independent dream me, there appears to be an independent dream world out there. And therefore, in the dream, when we encounter something pleasant or unpleasant in the dream, we react with attachment, aversion. If it's something horrible, often a lot of fear and anxiety. But if in the middle of the dream, suddenly we realize we're dreaming, meaning lucid dreaming, then there will still appear to be an independent dream me, there'll still appear to be an independent dream world out there, but because we're lucid now, we will directly realize this dream appearance is deceiving us. And then if we see something pleasant and unpleasant in the dream, it would be very hard to react with attachment and aversion. And we would enjoy the dream a hell of a lot more. This view is saying the waking life is like a dream, meaning now we are asleep with ignorance, meaning there appears to be an independent me here, an independent world out there. And so when we encounter pleasant and unpleasant things, we react with attachment and aversion. But if we become lucid in our waking state by realizing emptiness, then when we come out of that meditation, there will still appear to be an independent me here. There'll still appear to be an independent world out there. But because we've realized emptiness now, we will directly know that this appearance is deceiving us. We will never buy into it, which means it would become very difficult, if not impossible, to react to pleasant and unpleasant things with attachment and aversion, and we would enjoy our waking life a hell of a lot more. So this is an analogy I find particularly useful, and also it can actually be quite helpful to develop lucid dreaming, which is not that difficult. Because often people who first develop lucid dreaming, often one of the things that they report is that they're completely amazed at how vivid and real a reality their mind can produce. So that lucid dream can help them to then maybe start questioning the waking world. So it can be a good way of starting to doubt the way things exist. Of course, we're not saying the waking world is a dream. You have to be very careful about that. We're saying it's like a dream. Because in a dream, we can manipulate appearances. We can't do that in the waking world. So remember, it's not an example, it's an analogy. The analogy is to show that things are maybe not as they appear. You have to be clear about that.
I learned a bit about discipline when I train. And what I see is that you can have a discipline. If you know from the waking life that it's possible to wake up in your dream. But when you are in the waking life, you never have access to this, you know, reality. What I mean is that meditation in the waking life, we can pass from the waking life to the lucid dream, but we cannot pass from the lucid dream. It's hard to explain. We can realize that dreams, that we can lucid dream, because we are awake in a waking life. But when we are awake from this waking life,
now you lost me there.
Yeah.
You mean the dreams relative to the waking life?
To reach the lucidity in the waking life
requires a direct realization of emptiness.
Yeah.
So,
but it's not the same as lucid dreaming.
It is. It is, in fact. It is. And I was going to talk about this afternoon, but I'll bring it in now. This practice, like any practice, we go through three stages. And I like to use the Tibetan words here because they're very short. Go nyam tok. Go means intellectual. For any practice. Any practice. In this case, I'm using this to talk about emptiness. But it applies to every practice. So first, of course, any practice we want to do, we have to receive instructions, think about it. We have to produce a map. That's intellectual. Then we go in the territory. We meditate on whatever. Here we're talking about emptiness. So we're doing a meditation on emptiness, looking for the me. We don't find. We hold that experience as long as we can. And maybe that experience stays with us a little bit after the meditation. This is nyan. Taste or experience. Which means that for that time, instinctively, not intellectually, instinctively, we are seeing things in the correct way. We are seeing directly that these appear, like a lucid dream, we are knowing that these appearances are deceiving us. Instinctively, not intellectually, instinctively, like a lucid dream.
But because you are intellectually, in the waking life, initiates this reflex, you know, this reality test and things like that.
This
No. That you can have this experience during the wisdom.
No, you lost me. Anyway, let me finish this. But of course, this experience will wear off very quickly, gone. And then we'll go back to grasping onto things and problems. So what we want to do is we want to stabilize this. We want to make it longer lasting. And that's talk. And that is realization. We want a stable experience of emptiness, we're trying to get a direct realization of emptiness in meditation. For this, we need a very stable, clear mind. We need concentration. We need shamatha, that level of concentration. That's why shamatha practice is so important. If we want to realize emptiness directly, we need such a very stable and clear mind. If we don't have that, at best, we'll have some little taste of emptiness and very quickly it'll be gone. So if we want to go to the next step, we need a very stable mind. And then we can come to realize emptiness directly. Then that experience will pervade our life. Meaning that still, like a lucid dream, even though we've realized emptiness and we've realized that things are not as they appear in daily life, there will still appear to be an independent me, there'll still appear to be an independent dream world there. But because we've realized emptiness, we never accept these appearances. Like a lucid dream, we will directly see that these appearances are deceptive. And therefore, very difficult, if not impossible, to generate attachment, aversion, and so forth. Maybe try again, very shortly.
Yeah, very good. We try when we want to have lucid dream experience, we try during the waking life to...
Try what?
To develop some reflex. For example...
Reflex?
To test the reality in the waking life, you know?
There are a number of methods in daily life that can help.
Yeah.
But we don't have to do that. We can have lucid dreaming spontaneously.
Yeah, but that's because of...
Because of what?
Of a brain conception that is different from for each person.
So I'm still not getting your point here.
In that, it's because of capacities that you have in the waking life that you can have lucid dreaming.
So?
So, if you don't know the capacity of the reality, you can...
I think most people... who, whichever method they use, and there are many methods to induce lucid dreaming, I would say 95% of those people don't have this view at all.
Which one?
I think what he's saying is that to induce a lucid dream in your waking life, you need to have some appreciation of this view of reality. Is that right?
Yeah.
I think that's not the case.
Well,
is that what you're... I'm lost then. I thought what you're saying is that to be able to induce a lucid dream in your waking life, you have to already have an idea that things are not existing as they exist.
To have lucid dream, you have to work during your waking life.
You have to
work. To train. You have to train during your waking life.
And?
But in the waking life, you don't have this access to the emptiness to train in the emptiness. If you have to train in the waking life in order to have a lucid dream,
right.
If you want to reach the emptiness in the waking life,
right.
You should train in the emptiness in order to become lucid during your waking life.
Just like you need to train to become lucid in sleep.
Yeah.
So like, I'm still not catching the point.
Realization of emptiness comes in lucid dreams, but in order to have lucid dreams, you need to practice in reality.
Ah.
I mean, there you don't have that.
But just because we have a lucid dream doesn't mean we're understanding this at all.
I know, and that's
how
the problem.
You
have lucid dreams because you know from I have in my mind there that there is dream and there is reality, and I know what is the dream and I know what is the reality, so I can link the two. But because of that, I don't know what is emptiness. I cannot make the connection.
You're saying that it's not automatic that if you have a lucid dream, you're appreciating this in daily life?
No.
What are you saying?
We need emptiness, we need lucid dream.
No, absolutely not.
No, but...
I don't think that's what he's saying. You're not saying we need to do lucid dreaming to realize this.
What I mean is that I can have the experience. I know what is the experience of the dream.
Lucid dream?
No, the basic dream. I know what is the experience of the dream. And I know what is the experience of the reality, waking life.
But what's that saying?
And because I know the two,
right.
I can bring the consciousness of the waking life into the dream, and I become lucid in the dream.
Cool.
But...
So?
But it's because I have this knowledge of the dream and the waking life. But
I don't think that's necessarily true. I think there are many people who do lucid dreaming without this knowledge.
No,
but what do you mean?
We all know that we can dream and we can.
Yeah, but I think there are many people who get a lucid dream without intellectually thinking about this in waking life.
Yes, but that's because of.
I'm still not getting your point. Maybe you can talk to me later. I'm sorry, I'm not really getting what you're saying there. Sorry.
Can you just say a little bit about emptiness and ethics? Does it?
Yeah, and I briefly touched on this before. Is that if we, and it ties in here, if we're having some experience, we've had some experience of emptiness or realization in meditation. And that experience is still affecting us in daily life, still, the flip side of emptiness is dependent arising. Means we are directly experiencing the interconnected nature of reality in daily life. Meaning that the natural expression of that is spontaneous loving kindness and compassion, and to be unethical would never even enter our mind. It would be impossible. So you would be completely ethical if you were still in this experience.
So it would be a nihilistic... Because I'm just wondering if people sort of learn this sort of philosophy and then say, well, nuclear warfare is inherent of... or is empty of inherent... existence is only good or bad because we define it as...
And that's nihilism. That because it's empty, it doesn't matter. That's nihilism. That's a wrong view of emptiness, which of course is possible. As I said, for us there are only two possibilities now, either this or this. That's why when we receive teachings and think about and contemplate emptiness, we must contemplate on dependent arising. Otherwise, yes, we can fall to the extreme of nihilism and come up to the conclusion that emptiness means nothing really exists, emptiness means nothing really matters. This is a false view of emptiness. So therefore, it's very important to reflect on the flip side as well, dependent arising, to really come to appreciate because things are empty, everything matters. Because everything's empty, ethics is the only thing to do. That is the correct understanding of emptiness. Yeah, then we a couple more things. Last question.
Just, I'm not sure about the two extremes. Because
yeah.
Why isn't it like a so-called better perspective to see life as everything does exist by its own side and independently, but we don't have the knowledge and the perspective to understand that now. Therefore, we give... We label it and we give it meaning, and then it becomes dependent on our perspective.
But if we believe things exist from their own side, we end up in this problem. We end up with attachment to pleasant things, aversion to unpleasant things.
Why? Because if you understand that you are the one giving it meaning, I mean, matter and energy is there. It's just we give it the meaning, okay, so it's a laptop now.
I think quantum physics would not really agree with what you said. That matter and energy is there.
It's there. And no, until quantum physics says that we, once we observe, we give it...
No, then it comes into existence. Only then. Not before. quantum physics.
I think it means that every atom or electron can be matter and wave at the same time until we give it the meaning.
I think in quantum physics they talk about this sort of superimposition state, that things only come into existence when there's an observer.
Okay. Yeah. So things are
not existing unless there's an observer, is the quantum physics
one. Well, it's also a theory.
Of course, these are all theories. Of course, they're all theories.
I understand.
Of course, they're all theories.
No, I understand that completely. What I'm trying to say is that we don't have the knowledge and to say things are not existing by its own side. We just don't know that yet.
That's right. And so here is Buddha's experiment that he's presenting to you for you to find out whether that's the case or not.
Okay.
Unless you do the experiment, it's just another theory, which may or may not be valid, may or may not be useful. So again, getting some good intellectual understanding of this view is not going to help anything.
Right.
I mean, it's a map, but unless we use the map to explore the territory, we'll never know whether that's true or not. It's just another theory. Another theory.
Okay.
And of course, the bottom line here is that the Buddha was not a philosopher. He was a doctor. He was trying to help us to overcome suffering. So the whole idea here is not so that we can have some fantastic philosophy. The whole idea here is to overcome our suffering. So maybe there's a good incentive to investigate this theory and see whether it's actually true and helpful or not.
It's the realization that we give meaning to everything we see. It doesn't mean that it don't exist by its own, because we don't know if it exists by its own or not, but we give meaning to everything.
And I think what you'll find is that you'll get the answer when you run the experiment, who am I? You'll get the answer,
okay.
One way or the other.
Okay.
Right. One more thing and then maybe some more questions. I just want to finish one more thing. We're running out of time. But with respect to this, we can also talk about what's called the two truths. There is what's called conventional truth and ultimate truth. These two truths are not two different realities. Conventional truth is what exists. So, of course, what exists are all these dependent arisings. And ultimate truth is how do all of these things exist? And here, the Buddhist assertion is that everything that exists is empty of independent existence. So ultimate truth is emptiness. So again, this dependent arising and emptiness are like two sides of a coin. That emptiness is how all of these things exist. And to talk a little bit more about that, I'd just like to briefly read from a book I read from earlier, What Makes You Not a Buddhist. And he's talking about here these two truths. And here he calls conventional truth relative truth. And he says the following. In Buddhist philosophy, anything that is perceived by the mind does not exist before the mind perceived it. It depends on the mind. It doesn't exist independently, therefore it doesn't truly exist. That is not to say that it doesn't exist somewhat. Buddhists call the perceived world relative truth or conventional truth. A truth that is measured and labelled by our ordinary minds. In order to qualify as ultimate truth, it must not be fabricated, it must not be a product of the imagination, and it must be independent of interpretation. Although Siddhartha realized emptiness, emptiness was not manufactured by Siddhartha or anyone else. Emptiness is not the result of his revelation, nor was it developed as a theory to help people be happy. Whether or not Siddhartha taught it, emptiness has always been emptiness. Although paradoxically, we can't even really say that emptiness has always been, because it is beyond time and has no form. Nor should emptiness be interpreted as negation of existence. That is, we can't say that this relative world doesn't exist either. Because in order to negate something, you have to acknowledge that there is something to negate in the first place. Emptiness doesn't cancel out our daily experience. Siddhartha never said that something spectacular, better, purer, or more divine exists in place of what we perceive. He wasn't an anarchist refuting the appearance or function of worldly existence either. He didn't say that there is no appearance of a rainbow and that there is no cup of tea. We can enjoy our experience, but just because we can experience something doesn't mean that it truly exists. Siddhartha simply suggested that we examine our experience and consider that it could be just a temporary illusion, like a daydream. If someone asked you to flap your arms and fly, you would say, "I can't," because in our experience of the relative world, it is not physically possible to fly. But suppose that you are asleep and dreaming, and that you are flying through the sky. If someone in the dream says, "Human beings can't fly," you will say, "Yes, I can, see," and you will fly away. Siddhartha would agree on both counts. You can't fly when you're awake, and you can fly when you're asleep. The reasons are the causes and conditions that have or have not come together. A condition necessary to be able to fly is to be dreaming. When it is not there, you can't fly. When it is, you can. If you dream that you are flying and continue to believe that you can fly even after you wake up, that becomes a problem. You will fall and you will be disappointed. Siddhartha says that even when we wake up in the relative world, we are asleep with ignorance. When the right causes and conditions come together, anything can appear. But when those conditions are exhausted, the appearance stops. Viewing our experience in this dream as a dream, Siddhartha found that our habit of fixating on the mere appearance of our dreamlike relative world, thinking that it is truly existing, throws us into an endless cycle of pain and anxiety. We are in a deep sleep, hibernating like a silkworm in a cocoon. We have woven a reality based on our projections, imagination, hopes, fears, and delusions. Our cocoons have become very solid and sophisticated. Our imaginings are so real to us that we are trapped in the cocoon. But we can free ourselves simply by realizing that it is all our imagination. There must be infinite ways to wake up from this sleep. Even substances like peyote and mescaline might give us a vague notion of the illusory aspect of reality. But a drug cannot provide total awakening, if only because this awakening is dependent on the external substance. And when the effect of the mescaline is gone, the experience is gone as well. Suppose that you are having a really bad dream. All it takes is a flicker of realization that you are dreaming to wake you up. The spark can come from within a dream. When you do something anomalous within the dream, you may be jostled into realizing that you are asleep. Peyote and mescaline can spark a short-lived realization by revealing the power of the mind and the imagination. Hallucinations help us temporarily recognize how tangible and believable illusions can be. But such substances are not advisable because they provide only an artificial experience, one that can actually harm the body. Instead, we should have the aspiration to wake up once and for all without depending on external input. We are much better off when realization comes from within. What we really need is to wake up from our habitual patterns, imagination and greed. Mind training and meditation are the swiftest, safest and most effective ways to work within the mind stream. As Siddhartha said, you are your own master. A lot more to be said, of course, about emptiness. And what I'd like to do this afternoon is talk about the person, because that's where it sort of really gets interesting. You know, now we've talked about laptops and pens and objects. And often in the texts, when they introduce the topic of emptiness, they often introduce it talking about physical objects because it's a little bit easier to sort of understand. But when it comes to meditating on emptiness, often it's recommended we turn our attention to me, the person. How do I exist? And so that's what we're going to do this afternoon. So we've run out of time here. I'm sure there's still lots of questions, but we'll keep them until this afternoon. And maybe some of those questions you can also discuss in your discussion group. So first, some questions for discussion group. First question is, what does emptiness mean to you? What does emptiness mean to you? Second part of the first question, is emptiness the same as things being interdependent? Is emptiness the same as things being interdependent?
What is interdependent?
Interdependent. Well, again, it depends. That's why I asked the question, because we all have some sort of understanding of interdependency, so that's part of the question.
I'm not the native
speaker, so interdependent. Maybe someone can give him a word in Hebrew.
Yeah.
Interdependent. He wants Hebrew, I think. Okay. The second question is, how would an experience of emptiness affect our experience? So how would an experience of emptiness affect our experience of eating a delicious piece of chocolate cake? How would an experience of emptiness affect our experience of eating a delicious piece of chocolate cake? Second part of the question is, how would an experience of emptiness affect our experience of meeting an irritating person at work? How would an experience of emptiness affect our experience of meeting an irritating person at work? And the third question goes back... Sorry?
Can I say it again, please?
Yeah. How would an experience of emptiness affect our experience of meeting an irritating person at work? The third question goes back to yesterday afternoon's topic about... particularly, we talked about self-cherishing versus cherishing others. So the first part of the third question is it bad or wrong to want ourselves to be happy? Is it bad or wrong to want ourselves to be happy? Second part, third question is, how could we survive in the real world if we just cherished others? How could we survive in the real world if we just cherished others?